In lab today, and one of the things that I've kind of been rethinking how to work this, because we do have a fairly large group. So what I'm going to do is split you into two groups, and I'll show you how that's going to work. And one group will come at 1:30, and then the other group can come about 2:30 or so. So there'll be a little bit of overlap, but I think that's probably enough time that we won't have 23 or 24 people in the lab at the same time, because I don't think that's going to work very well. And then what I can do next week, if we do the same thing, is just switch off. But I'll show you that in a second. But here are the five things that we're going to be focusing on in lab today. And soil texture, rock fragments, which we talked about the other day, soil color, and then rupture resistance, which I think will come up this morning, and then effervescence, which we haven't said too much about. And so these are, you know, five morphological properties that want you to be able to describe. And so what you'll have in lab are some examples of these things to work through. And then for texture, as I mentioned the other day, we're going to have everybody practicing doing hand textures. And there'll probably be about five samples out that you can work on. So it is more or less self-paced. And I leave it up to everybody to decide how much time you need to spend on this stuff. But at the same time, you are responsible for learning it. And what I would also suggest doing, if you need some background information on this, if you have a textbook, I think you can find most of this in Chapter 2. I believe that it's pages 37 to 45. And you'll find a discussion, and it's fairly brief in most cases about these things, but it also has a couple tables that gives you the descriptors that are actually used for these things. And some of them you're probably already familiar with, you know, the textural triangle and so on. And I know a lot of you have used the Munsell notation. And I left one off here. Structure should also be on. And I think a lot of you are familiar with soil structure. So texture, structure, rock fragments, color, rupture resistance, and effervescence would be the topics. And then we'll do some more next week. And that should pretty much cover them all. The other thing you might want to look at is as far as sources. And let me go ahead and pull this down. But on the course webpage, I had a couple links on here for you that I just went over them real briefly last week, but if you look at this thing right here, the NRCS Field Book for Describing and Sampling Soils, this is probably the source document for a lot of the descriptors that we use in doing soil descriptions. And I do have it linked here. It's a PDF file. So if you click on it, you'll come to this page right here. And what you can do, if you just go to the table of contents, you can see a lot of things listed here. And so here's the profile PEDON descriptions. And, you know, for example, soil color. You go to this page, and then it's got a lot of information. I guess if there is a downside to it, it's probably more information than you really want, but it is thorough, and it will cover pretty much everything that you would ever want to know about soil color, soil structure, and so on. So that's the other source, and some people have printed these things out before, and I'll have some copies in the lab so you can refer back to them. But you might think about bringing your laptop if you want, where you could access this stuff, and it might be another option. I'll leave that up to you. So are there any questions about this, where to get information? Okay, then the one other source I will mention here too is this document right here. It's called the Soil Survey Manual. You notice the date on this, it's 1993. And if you use the link, it's an old book, you can tell, not a very fancy cover on it. And this was a government publication, and it also has a lot of this information about various descriptors and how to go about applying those. And you can see the table of contents here. And most of the information that you would be interested in is going to be in Chapter 3, where it says examination and description of soils. Some of the information may be a little more dated, but still, it's a great source if you want to get some more background on these various things and why they're important. So a lot of resources there that you can use. Any questions about this? Okay, and I'll also have some copies of this in the lab that you can take a look at too if you're interested. All right, the other thing, as far as how everybody's going to be split up, let's do it like this. And I don't get the impression I spent a lot of time coming up with this. There are a couple of things I wanted to consider, like the WSU folks are all together, so you can consolidate and carpool. If this really creates a problem for you, let me know. It's not too big of a deal to switch it. It's just that collectively, it's too many folks to have down there at one time. And even though there'll be a little overlap, I think we can make it work. So if you're in the left-hand column, come at 1:30, and you're welcome to stay as long as you feel like you need to. And then if the other group, if you come about 2:30, I think that we'll be able to accommodate everybody. All right? Yes, Mateo.
Just on the description of the book of 1999. So the evolution of the scripture is not so fast as in other science. I mean, something that is written in 1999 is still more.
For the most part, yeah. There, a lot of this stuff does evolve, but the changes that you see are generally pretty minor. You know, things like soil color. Once the Munsell system was worked out, there really wasn't too much to change on it. But some of the other things, probably the one feature you would notice the most difference in would be the rupture resistance. For this idea, and I'll say a little bit more about it here. So that's kind of changed, but most of the rest of it really hasn't. You know, related to that, soil science is not a particularly old discipline. And in fact, in this country, you know, nothing really got started until the early 1900s. So, you know, we're looking at something that's really on the order of about 100 years, or a little bit more in this country. Okay, so questions about this?
Is there a printout that we need to bring or anything?
No, I'll have some couple handouts for you that you can kind of use as a guide to make sure you look at everything. And so just bring yourself, and if you have, like you said, a laptop where you want to be able to look at some of this stuff, you're welcome to do that. Okay, so on Tuesday we started talking about a bunch of morphological characteristics, and I kind of went through them pretty quickly. We talked about texture and color, and I think we were looking at rock fragments when time ran out. And I want to revisit that for just a moment, because we talked a little bit about the size fractions with rock fragments, and I didn't get a chance to write that up on the board, but I think it's worth just taking a moment to run through this. I think everybody is very familiar with the different size classes for sand, silt, and clay. Hopefully you will be. But then we mentioned as you get up above that, you're into the what we call gravel. And these are, you know, particles that you'll find in many soils that are larger than 2 millimeters in diameter. And if we keep going up, we have what are known as cobbles, and then we have stones and boulder sized material. And what we normally do, if you think about a rock, you know, maybe it looks something like that. And so we kind of use the maximum diameter there as the way of separating these things out. And I think I went through this real quickly the other day, but Gravel would be the material that would range in size from 2 millimeters up to, anybody remember?
7.6.
Yeah, it should be about 75 millimeters, okay? There's gonna be some rounding off error, but in terms, a lot of people like to think in inches, right? And in fact, the USDA did for a long, long time, but if you want to think about this in terms of inches, be about 3 inches, okay? So you're looking at a diameter, maybe about like that, for gravel size material. And then with the cobbles, these would be from 75 millimeters up to 250. And again, if you want to think about the range in inches, that would be from 3 up to 10 inches. The stones are going to go from 250 millimeters up to 600. And 600 millimeters is roughly very close to 24 inches. So you put 10 to 24 inches there. And then the boulders are going to be greater than 600, or this effective diameter greater than 24 inches. So they're big rocks. And more specifically, they're boulders. So just be aware that there are these names that probably get applied pretty loosely in a lot of cases, but they do refer to a specific size range of rock fragments. So what we do then, if I showed you the example of the soil profile the other day that had the lots of rocks in there, and what we have to do is estimate how many of these things are there in a soil that we're trying to describe. And the normally what you'll see is if you've got at least 15%, that's enough in there that it's probably going to affect some of the properties and land use interpretations and so on. So what we would do, using those charts like I showed you, you would try and estimate the percentage of these rock fragments. And if you have between 15 and 35%, then what we would use is what's known as the rock fragment modifier. And let's just say that they happen to be gravel size, okay? Pretty common. So we might then describe the soil texture as a gravelly loam rather than just a plain old loam, or a gravelly sandy loam, or a gravelly clay loam, whatever the case may be. And as we start to increase the number of coarse fragments, we go from 35 up to 60%. And that's getting to be an awful lot if you look at some of those charts. We would refer to it as a very gravelly loam, or again, whatever the case of the textural class. And then we get into another category, if we're, say, 60 up to 90%. And that's really getting to the point where the rock fragments are going to dominate the soil property. And we would call we'd modify it as an extremely gravelly loam. And if it's greater than 90%, which you're not going to run into this too often, but at this point we don't really consider it soil material anymore, and we would just call it gravel. Yeah?
Is it just referring to gravel in the sense, or are we talking about cobble, stone?
It just depends, and I think the example I showed you, most of the rock fragments in there would be in this stone size category. So then you would call it a stony loam, or a very stony loam, extremely stony, whatever the case may be. And that kind of raises another question. What do you do if you have both gravel and cobble size material? It's not uncommon to run into something like that. That gets a little bit tougher, and what you generally will do is estimate the total percentage of both, you know, collectively, and then decide which one's going to be the more dominant. Do you have more gravel, or do you have more cobbly size material? And for simplicity's sake, a lot of people will just list that one. But I've seen folks actually try to estimate gravel size material and cobble size material and so on. It gets to be difficult to do. But this is really the main thing, is just putting it in one of these classes, because as we're going to see later when we get into classification, this makes a difference in some of the classification categories that we'll use. Any other questions about this? Okay, so that's the rock fragment. And let me, I might as well go back to what we were doing the other day. So here was the example of the soil profile. And I think everybody would agree that the percent sand, silt, and clay might be important in this soil, but equally, if not more important, is going to be the rock fragment content. And so, you know, typically the estimates are done using this type of a system. And I think we decided on 40% is a reasonable estimate there. If you look at the size of these guys, it's a mix, but most of them fall in that stone category. So we would end up using this, the nomenclature here, we would call it a very stony loam. Okay? Makes sense? One of the things that's in that field guide for describing soils, it has a lot of these kinds of charts, you know, where you can estimate percentages, and they're kind of fun to play around with, but like I mentioned the other day, people almost always overestimate. So it's something that takes quite a bit of practice to get to the point where you can do it consistently and accurately. Okay, the next topic that we're going to cover is soil depth. And this is we think of it as a morphological property, and really it in some soils it can be an overriding property. In other words, if you look at these two soil profiles here, the one on the left, there's not a whole lot of soil material there. It's mostly rock. So that soil, it looks like there's a couple inches of it. That might be the most fertile, best soil in the world, but if you only have a couple inches of it, that's really not going to translate into much in terms of productivity and so on. So it's really important to indicate something about soil depth, or what we also think of as it's the available rooting volume or rooting depth of the soil. And it really does have a lot of implications for plant growth. And what we do is we use five different categories. And these range from a very shallow soil to a very deep soil. And I'll write these on the board in just a second. But this one on the left, what do you think, given that range of descriptors, what do you think that one on the left would be? Very shallow, yeah. And in fact, shallow means that the effective soil depth is less than 25 centimeters. So that would be, what, 10 inches or so. The one right here, this is a soil from down in southern Idaho. Here's some more bedrock. These divisions here are decimeters or 10 centimeters each. So the effective soil depth here would be probably right about there, 40 something centimeters. And that would put it in the shallow category. So a shallow soil has an effective depth of 25 to 50 centimeters. And these next two soil profiles, the one on the left here is a local soil, and it's very difficult to see. And we'll talk more about this, but right about here begins a soil layer that we call a fragipan. And this is a very dense, restrictive horizon. Roots can't penetrate it. Water cannot penetrate very easily. So even though it's soil material, because it is root restrictive, the effective soil depth here is going to be from the surface down to this. Now, the divisions on that scale are in decimeters again, so this would be about 80 centimeters effective soil depth, and that's what we would put in the moderately deep category. That would be between 50 and 100 centimeters. And then on the... on the right is a nice bright red soil from Hawaii. And here we are down at over 5 feet, and there's absolutely nothing there to prevent rooting or anything else. So this would be an example of a very deep soil, or one that's greater than 150 centimeters of effective rooting depth. So pretty simple system, and I'll write these things up on the board for you. So at the low end of the scale, we have very shallow, and as we said, that's less than 25 centimeters in depth. Shallow would be 25 to 50. We have moderately deep, and that would be 50 to 100 centimeters. A deep soil would be 100 to 150 centimeters. And then finally, very deep would be greater than 150 centimeters. So if you're looking at a soil description, it'll say Palouse silt loam. These are very deep soils. And so they mean that you've got at least 150 centimeters of a rooting depth there. Okay, questions about that?
Is that the same as depth to a restrictive layer?
It would essentially be the same thing. I guess the question is, the restrictive layer, you know, by definition, it at least for effective soil depth, it has to restrict roots,
yeah,
and water movement. So, you know, where sometimes that's a little bit of a gray area. But in many cases, it's pretty straightforward. You can tell by observation, because roots are visible in a soil profile. And you can tell where roots stop and where they're not present pretty easily. Okay, so the next thing I want to go over very quickly is related to soil structure. And you know, this is, one of the most important soil characteristics that we have, morphological characteristics, and unfortunately it's largely ignored many times. And if you remember from intro soils, how do we define soil structure? Somebody got a definition? Now come on. I thought I had this thing figured out. But if you think back to intro soils, come on, what would be a definition for structure?
How the soil is aggregated together?
Yeah, it's nothing more than aggregation, or you could say the arrangement of sand, silt, and clay particles into aggregates, something along those lines. And you remember the terms that we use are things like granular structure that you might find up at, typically in an A horizon, and it's these little granules that you see there. Platy structure, where you've got these horizontal planes of weakness. Often platy structure is found up in a surface horizon or near surface horizon. The prismatic structure, and I'll have to point that out on this one, but you can see these very these vertical planes of weakness. And if I had a knife and I was picking away at the soil profile, the aggregates of soil that are coming out might look like this remote, where the vertical axis is greater than the horizontal axis. And it's typical in B horizons of soils to find something like prismatic structure. The other thing that we might find in B horizons would be blocky structure. Doesn't show up real well on here, but down in this zone in the soil, the subsoil area, the aggregates come out and they're roughly equal dimensional. In other words, the vertical axis would be roughly equivalent to the horizontal axis. And they look like blocks. What does subangular mean? Well, it means that the edges of those blocks, think about a block that a kid would play. Those are very sharp edges, right? So if you take those and round them off, then you would end up with something that we might describe as a subangular block. And you'll see some examples of these in lab, and I know a lot of you have looked at them in the Soil 206 lab. A couple other types, there's something known as columnar structure, and you can see some here. It's a lot like prismatic structure, except the tops are kind of rounded there. And this is almost always found in soils that we describe as being sodic soils or sodium affected soils. And the sodium is what causes these rounded caps on there. And it's kind of a specialized type, but you will find it down in southern Idaho, some of the drier areas, the slick spots that are in rangelands, and out in the Columbia Basin, some of those soils have this columnar structure in it. And you can see the this other photo. This is looking down on top of one of these horizons with columnar structure. And people have described this as biscuit top, you know, that kind of appearance, because it looks like a pan full of biscuits, the way the columns that are in that subsoil, the way that they fit together, and you get those rounded caps on them. Okay, the next image here, that ruler that you see in there is 12 inches long. And you notice the size of those aggregates? Well, they're pretty big, and in fact, these are not naturally occurring soil aggregates or PEDs, but they're ones that have been created through, in this case, cultivation. And we refer to those as clods. So I know when a lot of you were kids, you might have had a dirt clod fight, or at least that's what it's called. And I guess I'd think about that. Number one, it probably wasn't dirt, right? And number two, you might have actually been fighting with PEDs rather than clods. The only distinction is the clods are created by some sort of disturbance, and the PEDs are the naturally occurring soil aggregates. Well, why is soil structure important? What does it do? It's just aggregation of sand, silt, and clay particles.
It influences water movement.
Yeah, it is probably one of the most important determinants of how water moves in a soil, how water is stored in a soil. It affects rooting patterns of plants, and I think of pore space or the development of structure as what really dictates kind of the plumbing and the ventilation system in a soil. So gas exchange as well as water movement are greatly affected by the type of structure that's there. So it's really an important thing to be able to recognize and describe in a soil profile. And not every soil has soil structure. This next image is an example of a soil that is probably fairly sandy, and it does not have any aggregation. All of you have seen beach sand, right? Is there any aggregation there? No, you just have a whole bunch of sand grains that don't stick together. And that would be an example of what we would call a structureless soil. So there's no structure to it. And it could be because it's real sandy, there's no aggregation, or it could be that it's a extremely clayey material or young material that just hasn't had time to develop any kind of a repeating structural pattern. And in which case we might refer to that as massive. But what we're going to be doing in here as far as describing soil, you look at this next soil profile, and I put the note on here that a complete description of soil structure includes three things: the structure grade, the structure size, and the structure type. Now, the structure grade refers to how well expressed that structure is. Is it strong structure? Is it moderate or is it weak? And the way you tell that usually is visually, if you can look at a horizon and it's real clear that there are prismatic structural aggregates in there or granular aggregates, that's probably strong structure. And we only use three categories there: weak, moderate, or strong. The size of the aggregates refers to the dimensions of the aggregates. And these vary depending on whether you're talking about granules or blocks or prisms, and that's something that you can look at in those materials that I was talking about for lab today, okay? But the sizes generally range from what we would call very fine up to very coarse. Obviously, the very coarse would be the large ones. And then type is simply what we were looking at, where it's granular or it's subangular blocky or it's prismatic or it's platy. So in a soil like this, now you're looking at about a 4 foot exposure. Do you see any, can you see structure in there, first of all? Okay, and it, for example, up top, what does it look like? Yeah, that looks like pretty good granular structure. So that would probably be of the strong grade. And then it's kind of hard to tell here about size, but type, we already decided it would be granular. How about down in here? What does this look like? Kind of looks like prismatic. You see these very noticeable vertical planes in there, so that would be a good guess. And again, pretty well expressed. So we might end up in a typical soil profile, not just having one type of structure, but maybe several. So the complete descriptions I put on the side here, up top in the A horizon, strong, fine, granular structure, some grade, size, type. Down here in the B horizon, strong, coarse, prismatic. And then maybe down further in here, moderate, coarse, subangular, blocky structure. Yeah?
You pretty much always just have one per horizon, though?
Well, you usually will have one dominant type. And that's not to say that you won't notice some, you know, maybe blocks or prisms both. But again, it comes down to a bit of a judgment call. And typically what you'll do is just describe the one that's the more prevalent. Now, some people in these descriptions, if, as you look at some soil descriptions this semester, you'll see that we have folks that are known as splitters, and we have people that are known as lumpers. So, and you'll probably fall into one of those two categories. A splitter might describe that up the structure up there in the top as strong, fine, granular structure parting to moderate, weak, subangular, blocky structure, and you know, just quite a bit of detail. And there's nothing wrong with that, but I guess you just have to ask yourself, you know, what's the intended purpose of the description, and how do you convey the most amount of information? Okay, so that's the overview of soil structure, and you'll be looking at some different types. And I think in 206, you probably sat down and there was a tub full of granular structure, which, you know, it's not really the best way to look at it. And what I'll have you do is look at some of these soil monoliths that are hanging on the wall, because I think if you do that, it's a little bit more instructive to see the soil structure in place in the soil profile. Okay, next topic is rupture resistance. And this is a horrible slide to look at, but this is out of one of the references that I gave you. I think this might be from the textbook. But what we do is assess what's referred to as rupture resistance of soil aggregates. And the idea here is that we're trying to get some assessment of, I call it soil strength, but how does the soil respond to some type of an applied force or stress. And this really starts to get into an engineering type of a thing, where some soils don't have much strength. You can take an aggregate in your hand, and it's going to vary according to moisture content, but you can crush it easily. And there are other aggregates that you have to put down on the ground and maybe stomp on it to get it to fail or break apart. And that would obviously represent a lot of soil strain. So it's an engineering thing, but it also influences things like plant rooting patterns and so on. So here's how we do it. Normally, the description of rupture resistance is done according to moisture content. And this left-hand column here is titled moderately dry and very dry. I'm not sure I can tell the difference between moderately dry and very dry, so just call it dry soil, okay? Well, here are the categories of rupture resistance: loose, soft, slightly hard, moderately hard, very hard, extremely hard, and so on. And what this is referring to is how much force does it take to break an aggregate or cause it to fail. So if it's loose, well, this means the specimen not obtainable. Again, this might be like a sand where there's really no aggregation, so there's no PED to cause to fail by putting force on it. Soft, this aggregate would fail under very slight force. In other words, you put it between your thumb and forefinger, barely have to press on it, falls apart. You contrast that with something down here, let's look at very hard. Cannot be failed between thumb and forefinger, but can be between both hands or by placing on a non-resilient surface and applying gentle force underfoot. So not stomping on it, but maybe putting it on the ground or on the floor and a little bit of pressure, it breaks apart. And you might get down here to something like rigid. Cannot be failed underfoot by full body, meaning you can't break that by standing on it. And eventually you get down here that cannot be failed by a blow of less than 3 joules. Honestly, I don't know what a blow of 3 joules is, but that's a lot. And believe it or not, there are aggregates that you can take and really stomp on it, and they're not going to come apart when they're dry. A lot of strength there. So if you're into the physics of this, you can calibrate yourself to newtons or joules, whatever works best for you. But most people just kind of go by this idea that you try and break it and you come up with some assessment of how easy it is to do or how difficult it is to do. Now the second column is for, they're calling it slightly dry and wetter. I just call it moist, okay? So that would be for a moist soil. And some of the terms are similar, loose, where you don't get a specimen, you don't get an aggregate. But then you see terms here like very friable, firm, and getting down to extremely firm, slightly rigid, and there's the rigid categories again, reflecting a tremendous amount of soil strength. So this is something that it, with a little bit of practice, I think you can get the idea that some of these soil aggregates are pretty easy to get to fail, others are pretty difficult. And we've got a pretty good range that we can look at over the course of the semester. I wouldn't worry about this air dry, submerged, because that's not really something you're going to be doing in the field. So I would just focus on the dry descriptors and then the moist descriptors. Now we also have another test that's related to what we call plasticity and stickiness. And that's more or less something that's done on a wet sample. And in fact, a lot of times when you're doing a hand texture where you take the soil, you put it in the palm of your hand, you get it wet and you start working it up so you can try and form a ribbon and feel how much grit's in there. That would be about the right moisture content to determine how sticky the soil is and its plastic nature. And you can look at that in lab this afternoon. The plasticity is getting into a more of an engineering characteristic of, can you shape that wet sample and have it form a long plastic type of it's not really a ribbon, it's more of a wire, referred to as a wire. But you can see how that works. But these are fairly, I think can be fairly obvious when you start looking at soils. Not that you can, I'm not saying it's obvious to distinguish between moderately hard and hard, but certainly something that's soft versus something that's rigid or extremely hard. I don't think you'll have any problem doing that. Okay, questions? Anything about rupture resistance? Not clear. Okay, well, move on to the next type of morphological feature. And this is not so much a soil characteristic as it is one of the plants that are growing in the soil. And that's a description of roots. And what we typically do is try and describe the abundance of roots that are present in the soil horizon. And the way we will do it most of the time is that you look at a unit area, and in this case, because we're looking at what are primarily fine or very fine roots, we use a unit area of a square decimeter. And so you kind of have that frame that you're looking at. And then you look at, you can actually count or estimate the number of roots that are occurring within that square decimeter area. And we end up with a term or a descriptor like this, where the example here, this is an A horizon of a grassland soil. We would describe that as having many fine and very fine roots. And so we do have these size categories for roots, and the terms like this term here, many, refers to the abundance of them. And you can look at the categories in those references. I don't expect you to memorize all that stuff, which actually raises another point, and that is that for all of these descriptions that we're doing in these various morphological features, you will be preparing a field guide to help you do these types of descriptions without having to flip through a book or something like that. And I'll show you some examples in class that students have done in the past, but really, it's getting this information that you need to go out to the field and say, what's the root distribution here? And so you'll need some sort of a guide so you can assess the abundance of roots and the size of the roots and so on. Same thing with the structural aggregates and so on. So you might start thinking about that as you look through some of the reference material that I've mentioned. The other thing that we try to assess in the field, if possible, is pores. And this is an extremely difficult thing to do, but it's also pretty important because pores are where water moves and where gas exchange occurs. So it's also where a lot of roots might be found. This is actually a very thin slice of a soil horizon, and the areas that show up in the kind of a whitish blue color, those represent pore spaces, and then the brownish areas that you see, the darker areas, represent the soil material. And you can see that in this case, there are some patterns with these pores, how these long continuous pores here. I'm guessing that this is some sort of a prismatic, blocky type of structure that you might see in a subsoil. And in lab, you can see the conventions for trying to describe the pore space. In a lot of soils, the majority of the pore space is going to be in between structural aggregates. You know, that's a very common one. In sandy soils, where you don't have structural aggregates, the pore space is simply going to be in between the adjacent sand grains. So it's going to vary, and it is a difficult thing to describe, but what is very helpful is if you're looking at a soil and you notice patterns in the pore distribution, if you can somehow capture that, it turns out that's usually a very, very important bit of information about that soil, because it tells you a lot about potential for water movement. And
did you quantify porosity?
In the field, it's not very easy. There are ways to do it in a lab, but it's bulk density measurements would be the simplest way for getting a total amount of porosity, but it doesn't tell you anything about macro pores versus smaller pores. And that's something that these would be macro pores because they're large, and then there would be a lot of micro pores that are scattered within those aggregates. But tough thing to do, and I guess I'll just leave you with the advice, do the best you can. A couple other miscellaneous features that we'll be looking at, not this week, but next week in class. a lot of aggregates and even individual sand grains in soils have films on them or coatings of various kinds. The most common one would be clays that have moved from an upper horizon and they're carried down to a lower horizon. And oftentimes they'll form, you see this waxy stuff, it looks sort of like caramel. That's a clay film. And it's just the coating of these clays that have accumulated in the horizon. Sometimes these are very obvious in soils. You might need a hand lens. A simple 10 power hand lens is usually pretty good for observing these things. And actually, how many of you own a hand lens? Okay, quite a few of you probably needed them for some sort of plant ID, but they're very useful for soils too. And if you don't own one, I would recommend, I think you can get them at the bookstore. I know you can get them downtown here at the gym store down on Main Street. But get a hand lens. They're very fascinating to take to the field and start looking at things that maybe you haven't paid too much attention to. But soil materials, you'll see a lot of things like this with a hand lens that might not be visible otherwise. So films, coatings. There's something else called slicken signs. Anybody remember what these things are? You've seen the term before? Well, if you have a soil that has a lot of the shrinking and swelling clays, like in a vertisol, where as it gets wet or moist, the volume swells, and then as it dries, it all contracts. You get a lot of the aggregates moving back and forth against one another, and what it does is it creates this shiny, grooved surface on the exterior parts of these aggregates. And it's very diagnostic for vertisols and similar soils that have a very high shrink swell capability. And there'll be some examples of those for you to look at in lab. Surface cracks, the next image here. I'm sure all of you have seen this. This is just looking down at the soil surface, and you can see this network of cracks there, pretty good size. If you see that, what does that tell you?
Dry.
Well, it's dry, and then again, you've got those a pretty high content of shrinking and swelling clay. So obviously a pretty good thing to note if you're trying to describe a soil. Sometimes these cracks can be quite deep, and they are also diagnostic for vertisols and related soils. And then there's calcium carbonate. And I better stop here. But you'll see this in lab today, where we mentioned some of the white material that's common in soils is calcium carbonate. And there are different types of patterns that you might observe. But what's the way we tell if it's calcium carbonate? Yeah, we put some acid on it. You get a chance to play with that in lab this afternoon. Okay, so there's a couple more things, but I'll finish them up on Tuesday. And then the next topic we're going to get into is horizons. You know, another very obvious morphological characteristic of soils are these horizontal layers or horizons. And we'll go through those in quite a bit of detail for the next couple of class periods.